Evening, folks. You are listening to Gangland Wire, and we love this podcast in Scotland.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. I'm back here in the beautiful Ice House in Midtown Kansas City with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
You know, we've been talking about serial killers. I can't really say that word. We've been talking about serial killers for off and on for a while, and I was looking for something in the mob that was like a sociopathic killer. You know, I know they do hits and they kill people, usually kill their own members and don't really go outside. And there's this one guy back east called the Iceman. There's a documentary out there. I think there's even a narrative movie. I can't remember the name of it now. A guy named Kuklinski. And he probably would rank right up there, and he was connected to the mob, or a guy named Roy DeMeo. And we're going to talk about him one of these days. I've started to file on Roy DeMeo and this Richard Kuklinski. I'll have to look that pronunciation up. But here I've got one up in Chicago, for all you Chicago fans, that was pretty much a sociopathic killer and torturer and all-around horrible guy.
Serial killers of the mob nature from Chicago, wouldn't that include the German, Frank Suisse?
Well, he was a killer, that's for sure. He doesn't quite have, he would kill you, but he didn't quite have the reputation that this guy did. This guy is Mad Sam DeStefano. I got a message from a fan in Scotland, and he was wanting to, and I asked him, talked to him a little bit on the messaging function, and talked to him about what he might like to hear, what people over there in the British Isles would like to hear, and he mentioned Mad Sam DeStefano. And I'd heard of Mad Sam. Of course, all you guys up in Chicago know about Mad Sam. He's kind of the guy that taught Tony Spilotro all the tricks of the trade on being a gangster. He was one of the first guys that Spilotro was sent to his crew, or Spilotro joined his crew. But Mad Sam, we'll tell you a little bit about the history of Mad Sam. Mad Sam was born in 1909. And he would go on to become a big-time loan shark and a political fixer and a sociopathic killer for the Chicago outfit. There's a guy, a lot of you all know, former Chicago-based FBI agent named William F. Romer Jr. He wrote several books on the mob that a lot of people cuss and discuss and argue about whether he was telling the truth or making stuff up. But regardless what you think of Bill Romer, he did know the Chicago outfit better than anybody, and he considered DeStefano to be the worst torture murderer in the history of the United States. He said that this guy was a mentally unstable and sadistic person that was used by the outfit as an enforcer and a juice loan collector. Mad Sam was born in Streator, Illinois, downstate in Streator, Illinois. His father was a laborer named Sam DeStefano Sr. His mother's name Rosalie. Both of them had been born in Italy and had immigrated to the United States in 1903. So Mad Sam was a citizen. He was born here in 1909. His dad was kind of an up-and-comer in a way. He started out as a laborer, and he worked in a coal mine downstate in Herron, Illinois, and they had some labor-related turmoil. But I looked it up. It was the Herron Massacre. A bunch of union members killed a whole bunch of strikebreakers down there, and then the company brought in some thugs to beat up the union people. So he just got out and went up to Chicago and moved into Little Italy on the west side of the loop down there and around Taylor and Western, I think. And, you know, looking at Mad Sam, one of the early reports about his criminal activity was in 1926. He would have been about 17 or 18 years old. He was arrested and turned over to the Niles Police Department, which is a suburb of Chicago, as being a fugitive for breaking out of jail. He joined a gang. It was called the 42 Gang. And 1927, July the 1st, several hundred of these West Side gang members showed up threatening violence against a police sergeant for arresting DeStefano and for shooting DeStefano's associate, Harry Casgrove. So he had established a reputation by the time before he was 20 years old, really, and had people following him and looking up to him. Started out with a charge of rape. He, best I can gather, DeStefano and another gang member, Ralph Orlando, had waited outside a movie theater and found a 17-year-old girl walking there and walking home alone, and they forced her into an automobile and drove her to a garage where she was sexually assaulted by several other gang members. Orlando and DeStefano were found guilty of this crime. Now, he got a lighter sentence because somehow the police were called. I don't know how. If somebody, some neighbor must have heard the girl screaming or something. Police were called and they burst in and they arrived before DeStefano had the opportunity to rape the girl. So he had a much lighter sentence. He only did 3 years. He was a member of the 42 gang sometime during this time, which was the junior varsity, if you will, for the Chicago outfit. Many young guys of the farm team, many young guys in Chicago graduated from the 42 gang to join the outfit. And one of the most famous ones was Salvatore Sam Giancana, or Momo. They call him Momo. The press coverage that the 42ers had gotten for all their different crimes had captured the attention of the outfit, and particularly Al Capone, and they used them to do burglaries and fence their property for them and help in the bootlegging. They need a lot of people to drive trucks and guard truckloads of beer and help establish enforcement around speakeasies and set up speakeasies and gambling games. And they'd hire them for runners and truck drivers. And in a way, they were a little bit out of control, all these young guys, but they did have their uses and they did use them. And Giancana was probably one of the more highly skilled of these young guys, and he had a reputation as his early reputation was a skilled wheelman, and I don't mean a motorcycle officer. If you remember, Aaron, we had that whole conversation about if you're a wheelman, you're the getaway driver, or you're a motorcycle officer for the Kansas City Police Department. So he was not a motorcycle officer. He was a getaway driver, and he was known to be calm under pressure. He quickly became, Giancana, Momo, became a protege of Joe Battersicardo, and Paul the Waiter Rica, who were some of the early bosses after Al Capone and Frank Nitti.
Do you know why they called it the 42 gang?
I think it was because there were 42 members, wasn't there? I think, wasn't it? Or was it 42nd Street? God, I had that, and I didn't write that down.
Yeah, I know. I was looking at the notes. I think your note's a little bit fuller than mine, because I'm here at the DeStefano soon became involved in bootlegging and gambling. That's where my page starts.
No, you just didn't get to the front page.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where I had the blank stare as we were talking here.
On the 42. Oh, I see what you mean.
I would otherwise kind of try to bring it back to cue that if you had that in the notes and didn't say why.
Oh, here it is. Somehow I tore off two front pages. There's your front page. Okay. Giancana would bring a number of his 42 gang members like Mad Sam into the outfit, and he would go on to become the boss of the outfit by 1957. He will later kind of have to abdicate and travel to Mexico, and he will eventually be killed, but that's a whole nother story.
That's for, you mean Sam Giancana?
Sam Giancana, yeah. He's the one that brought Mad Sam DeStefano from the 42ers into the big time. DeStefano himself soon became involved in bootlegging and gambling. In 1932, he was wounded by a policeman during a grocery store robbery. Later that year in August, after that, DeStefano appeared at a hospital in Chicago's West Side with bullet wounds, which refused to explain. So he was getting around, but he was in his early 20s. In 1933, he must have been part of a robbery crew, because in 1933, DeStefano was convicted of a bank robbery up in New Lisbon, Wisconsin, and sentenced to 40 years in the penitentiary. Well, the political fix must have got put in, because within 8 years, his sentence is commuted by the governor, and he's released in December of 1944. DeStefano returned to prison in June 1947 for possessing counterfeit sugar ration stamps. Now, during the war, they had to ration tires and gasoline and sugar in particular, and I think there was meat was rationed too. And what these guys would do, DeStefano was working when he got out of the joint in 1944, at the end of the war, he was working in a place where they did printing, and so he had access to printing facilities, and he started printing up counterfeit sugar ration stamps and selling to people. He got popped for that, went back to the penitentiary, and this was a good penitentiary term for him. He was sent down to Leavenworth, and there he met outfit members Paul the Waiter Rica and Louis Campagna. When he came out in 1947, he must have got their attention, and he probably, made sure everybody was safe, and he was kind of a bad actor, so he was a tough guy.
They didn't even put him away for a year.
No, you wouldn't got too much time for that.
Even though
I don't
imagine prior convictions.
Yeah,
but he did serve a good stretch there from 1933 to
1942. Yeah, he did do 9 years there for the 40-year sentence in bank robbery. After he was released, he immediately got a civil service job with the city of Chicago as in the garbage part of the garbage dumping foreman. By 1952, the fix for him getting that job must not have stuck, or he probably created a lot of trouble or wasn't showing up or something, because city officials discovered that he had omitted his criminal record from his application. They didn't prosecute him, but I think he lost his job at that time. During the 1950s, he went on to be a full-time outfit loan shark operator. He started out using stolen money from his days as a bank robber and loaning out money at loan shark rates. He was really a businessman, Aaron. This guy, he started investing in Chicago real estate. If we'd invested in Chicago real estate in the 1950s and just hung on to it, we'd have done pretty good.
Yeah, it says here he's got a 24-suite apartment building and used the rent money for legitimate income to bribe local aldermen and other politicians.
That was his thing. And during the 50s, DeStefano really became one of the outfit's main political fixer. He found city officials, judges, policemen that he was paying off. He would brag that there wasn't any case he couldn't fix, and started offering his services out to the other mob guys. His fees, I understand his fees for doing things like fixing a robbery case was $800. An assault case, he charged $1,500 for. I guess he was like a lawyer. He had a flat fee. If you come to me for a traffic ticket and you tell me it's, like in Kansas City, I say, okay, that'll be $150, and the fine, I'll tell you what the fine is as soon as I go down and get the ticket reduced to a non-moving violation. So I guess it was $1,500 to fix or take an assault case on. He fixed first-degree murder cases. He did one for $20,000. I think this probably came out later in his life, probably when they did the Operation Greylord up there. DeStefano's arrangements with the police were so routine that sometimes corrupt police officers would just take their suspects by DeStefano's house, and then he'd pay off the cops. The suspects would then, even if they didn't have any money, they would be put on, that would become a juice loan, and then DeStefano would have them on the hook for a juice loan, a high interest loan rate. Say if he paid off the cops, gave the cops $1,000, and they'd owe DeStefano $1,000, plus they'd have to pay him about, like 300% interest every month on that. So that just extended his loan sharking activities. And by the 1960s, he was known as a leading loan shark in the Chicago outfit, which is that Chicago's a pretty big place, and they have a huge, big outfit. You know, by the 60s and 70s, really, Chicago had the biggest organized crime family in the United States, single family. Now, if you put all five families in New York City together, you would have a bigger family. But Chicago is a single family with a single boss, had the largest one in the United States. His loan shark's victims were not only these criminals and small-time criminals and some larger-time criminals that didn't have any money, needed money, also politicians and lawyers. He was charging 20 to 25% a week in interest. He would accept any high-risk debtors like drug addicts or businessmen who had already defaulted on other debts. But it's claimed that the reason DiStefano would do that because he enjoyed it when they didn't pay on time. Aaron, he had a soundproof torture chamber built into his basement, and he liked to bring those guys down there. So, Aaron, don't be borrowing any money from Mad Sam, a guy called Mad Sam. If you do, don't go over to his house.
Well, I was going to say, when we could, you know, if we wanted to get that apartment building, we could go rob a bank and start there. It seemed like it worked for DeStefano.
Yeah, it did.
And I'm not saying it could work for us, but I don't have a basement. What about you?
I do have a basement. It's kind of wet and dirty down there.
That's perfect.
It's perfect, yeah. It would be a perfect torture chamber.
Yeah, I mean, you're not really a political fixer, legal fixer, but for $150, it'll get you out of a speeding ticket and have it reduced
down. And if you don't pay me, I like that, because then I'm going to put you down in my basement and torture you for a little bit.
Get your feet wet.
You know, that's why I've got that acetylene torch down there. You don't want to know what you do with the torch. We'll get on to the vice later on. He'd been known to kill debtors who owed him small sums just so he'd scare others into paying their debts. I mean, this guy, here's another thing. This guy was canny, Aaron. This guy was really canny. He would give his loan shark victims, or shall we say clients, his debtors. He's the creditor, and his debtors, or loan shark victims, as the law enforcement would call them, he would give his debtors presents, like a gold watch with his name engraved on the back of it. And then if he ended up killing the victim and he was accused of it, he could say, well, no, why would I kill him? Look how close I was. He was wearing this gold watch that I gave him, and it's got my name inscribed on the back of it. That's how much he liked me. Guy was devious, wasn't he?
I don't know how that would actually come off as being some sort of substance evidence. Substantive.
Well, it wouldn't be substantive, but it might.
Supposition.
It would not be substantive evidence. You would have to make a supposition.
Because the guy's carrying a watch with your name on it, you're really good friends.
Well, it could be. I mean, why, you know, if I gave you a watch and gave you presents and then you ended up dead, well, I'd just say, well, look, man, I didn't kill him. He was my good friend. Look, I gave him all these presents. Why would I kill him? He was kind of an interesting-looking guy. I've seen pictures of him. He wears black, thick black horn-rim, or those black, yeah, horn-rim glasses. Kind of looks like a high school teacher or something.
A nerd?
A nerd, yeah.
People said that, though.
Yeah, no. And people believed he couldn't see without him, but in fact, those were just a cover. I mean, this guy was, he just lived a criminal's life.
I mean, besides him having thick horn-rim glasses, it says here that other gangsters said that the sadistic DeStefano would actually foam at the mouth while torturing his victims.
That's what I hear. That's what was been reported over the years. The guy was scary.
Now, that's the difference between what being, say, you're like, well, I'm just a contract killer. I'm an enforcer. I collect on the juice, and when they don't have the juice, I collect their body.
Right. And I get no pleasure out of it.
Yeah, I'm not actually a serial killer. I'm not a socio or psychopath.
Right.
As far as you know.
Right. It's not pleasurable. It's just business. But in this guy, it seemed like it was more than just business. He got a certain amount of pleasure out of it, it would appear to me. Normally, the outfit would not have probably had anything to do with a guy like this. He was...
But he was useful.
He was irrational, but he was useful. And he earned... Here's the thing, is he earned him a great deal of money, because every time he made a score, Giancana and Tony Accardo made a score, and they even invested some of their own money into his loan sharking operations. You see, that's one thing that they'll do. They'll say, hey, you got some money, let me put it on the street for you. And so, like, You're the loan shark, and I got an extra ten grand. I'll give you 10 grand. Then you, at your job, you'll know these different people that loan money, and you'll say, okay, this will, I'll give you 10 for 15, and I'll give you 20 for 30. And the understanding is, you got to pay the next paycheck in a week or so. You got to give me back $30, and so then you'll pay me. You'll take a little piece of that for making the loan, and I put up the money, and then I'll get the bigger piece of the vig or the interest rate on that. And so,
but if the
that's what Giancana was doing with him, they were putting $50,000 on the street, and he'd have to keep track of that separate from his own money.
From his own money,
right?
But when he was going out doing collections, if he didn't collect on money that he had loaned that was given to him by those guys, he still owed it.
He still owed it. Yes, yes.
So there must have been some good incentive for him.
Oh, yeah.
Because he knew who he was dealing with.
Yep.
And it's odd that there was all this word on the street. You talk about, the word on the street was, he'd collect on small debts, big debts, and if he didn't have the money, he'd maybe kill you or...
Just to make an example out of you.
Just to make an example out of you. It's word on the street.
Oh, this guy, he knew about sending a message. We got a story a little bit later. That's unbelievable that what he did. He even went after newspaper reporters. There was a Chicago Tribune reporter named William Daugherty who wrote a negative story about him, and DeStefano laid in wait for him. I think it was outside when he got off the paper one day, and he assaulted him. He chased him. He had a gun in his hand, and he threatened to shoot him and threatened his family. And when Daugherty ran away from him, he broke the windows on his car. That's when he started getting his name of Mad Sam, and everybody on the streets that were around him knew anything about him had knowledge that he was bizarre and crazy, and it just kind of keeps getting worse. You ever see these people? I remember somebody down on Main Street one time in front of a car dealership had bought a car, and they said it was a lemon, and the car dealer wouldn't do anything for him, so they set up out in front with pictures of on the signs of lemons and said this dealership sells lemons. You ever seen that, Aaron?
I haven't seen that.
They haven't done that for a long time. You don't hear that much anymore. That's how most states, or I think all states, it's
federal
a
lemon law?
Federal law. Now, actually, it's not state law. It's a federal law that it's called the lemon law. If you have a bad car that keeps going bad, and they can't fix it. Well, he bought one of those. It's a brand new car, and he wrote all over it, said this is a lemon, so everybody would know that this, that this car, whatever kind of car it was a lemon. And he also hung grapefruits all around it. I guess lemons weren't big enough, so he hung grapefruits on it.
No one probably noticed the lemons.
He wanted everybody to know. But this is a mob outfit dude who's doing that kind of stuff.
Well,
I can't believe they didn't go ahead and kill him early on.
I'd be kind of curious as to who the car dealership was that sold him the lemon.
Yeah, I would too. I wish I knew more about that story.
If they didn't know who he was, you would think that he'd probably let them know.
They were probably a protected dealer.
He might have come back and chased them around like he did to the William Daugherty.
Yep.
I mean, it's one thing to get some bad press. It's another thing to get a lemon for a car.
Here's another thing he does. He likes to pretend like he's a lawyer, and he always wants to be his own lawyer. One time, in the early 60s, he was arrested and with another fellow for forgery. And at their trial, he acted like he was a lawyer for both of them, and he demanded to know the names of all employees in the state's attorney's office and the sheriff's office so they could be called as witnesses. He liked to represent himself and make all kinds of crazy demands. Another time, he was so confusing that nobody in the courtroom even knew what he was talking about. He'd do stuff like, he walked up to the jury and he says, "Have you ever seen an elephant?" And they're just like looking like, "What?" "What? Have you ever seen an elephant?" And then just moments later, he turns to the judge and he says, "I plead guilty." And then he turned back to the jury and he said, "Something's come to light that I had not known before." And it was a disorderly conduct case. It was a small time case. He might not have represented himself, had done this, have been something with some serious jail time as disorderly conduct. So the jury found him guilty and fined him $100. Some of the people around him claimed that he would tell his compadres that It was his dream in life to own a pig farm so he could feed his victims to pigs. He claimed he even drove to pig farms just to watch them for hours. I mean, this guy, he was, as I said before, a half a bubble off a plum, or probably a whole bubble off a plum.
Well, I wonder, and he says he drove to pig farms just to watch them?
Just to watch them.
I wonder how many times you need to drive to a pig farm and watch pigs eating to think, well, that would really work to eat humans.
He's nuts.
Before you probably actually pitch a few, you know, arms and legs and torsos over the fence just to
see if they'd eat them.
Because you got them.
Yeah. I don't even know if hogs, are they vegetarian? Maybe they eat slop.
They don't eat about anything.
They'll eat anything.
Yeah,
okay.
Just throw it over the fence.
Here's another. There's an informant who will end up going into program and talking about DiStefano, and he claims that one time DiStefano got mad at his wife. Her name was Anita. He took out his gun, he put the end of the barrel in the mouth, and then told her to reach out and pull the trigger. And she wouldn't do it. And finally, he just started laughing, and then would go out and tell his mob buddies over and over again this same story about how he did that. This Bill Romer we talked about, FBI agent Bill Romer. Mm-hmm. Agents often would just show up at these mob guys' houses, just knock on the door and just say, how you doing? Just stop by and talk to them just to see, you know.
Just to kind of shake them up.
Just shake them up, or maybe maybe somebody would have some trouble and they'd be there at the right time. And they'd say, okay, here's my lifeline. I'm in big trouble and here's my lifeline. But anyhow, he was assigned to go to DiStefano's house periodically, or go find DiStefano and talk to him and just question him a little bit. And, you know, usually those guys just say, you know, I'm not talking to you. Well, he'd go over to the house and DiStefano would walk down the stairs in his pajamas, but he would have his penis hanging out while his wife was serving the agent's coffee. Another interesting thing, the agents would remark that coffee had kind of a funny taste to it. They didn't really like the coffee.
How many times did they have to go over for coffee before they figured out that?
Sam claimed, here's a good one, Aaron. Sam claimed the coffee was made from special Italian coffee beans.
Oh, I bet it was. Two of them. You ever heard of a tea bag?
Romer claims that he found out later that DiStefano had been peeing in the coffee before they brought it in to the agents.
I'm sure that the agents don't find that funny.
Man, I tell you what, Aaron, when I was a policeman in uniform and I was around people that were giving me anything to eat, I wouldn't take it unless I saw them do it. I saw them fix it. Like, I did not go into a restaurant and just order a meal. I never, ever would, unless I knew the people that were working there. There's another.
Well, I mean, I don't know. If I was DiStefano,
yeah.
I mean, he knows these guys aren't just stopping by to see how he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, they're hoping to catch him. They're hoping to kind of shake him up.
Yeah, he knows the deal.
I mean, if they're going to be silly enough to ask for coffee.
Really? That's what I thought.
and then sit down and drink it while his wife is, you know, serving them. And here he comes down in his pajamas with his junk hanging out.
Yeah.
I'd go, well, why are you making the coffee upstairs, Mrs. DiStefano?
Yeah, or why would you take anything?
And, you know, she's not going to say anything because
no,
he put a gun in her mouth.
Put a gun in her mouth, I'm telling you.
Taking the bullets out.
That was kind of they put the dysfunction in dysfunctional relationship, didn't they? Or the dis in dysfunctional relationship. Man, it's amazing what people do to stay married sometimes. I never had that trouble staying married.
Well, he probably did pretty well as a juice collector.
He did. I mean, he did. He had that reputation.
He did well enough that the mob bosses gave him their money to make money on.
Listen to this. He was in a little drug dealing caper with a bad Chicago cop named Tommy Dorso. Dorso started telling people that he once saw DiStefano roll around on the floor with spit running from his mouth, and he was yelling and begging Satan to show him mercy, screaming over and over again, I'm your servant, command me. So he was even like, another rumor about him, he was a Satanist and worshiped Satan, or he was possessed by the devil. I don't know. I mean, this guy was a piece of work. Here's one of the worst ones, one of the craziest ones, the stories that I found. Mad at his wife. He went out and he was in his car and he sees a guy walking down the street. He kidnaps a guy. He forces a guy into his car at gunpoint. He takes a guy to his house, and he forces the man at gunpoint to have sex with his wife for some imagined or real grievance that he had, some problem he had with his wife. Afterwards, supposedly, the man went to the nearest police station, reported the incident, but I don't think anything happened over that. I think probably they wouldn't even believe him. And if they did, it was Mad Sam, so what the hell?
Well, I would have a little bit of performance anxiety.
I know.
Mean, not that I know who Sam DeStefano is, but if I did, and he dragged me into his car at gunpoint, you know, it's hard to resist that. It's probably even harder to resist his wife.
Yeah.
When he's pointing a gun at you still.
Yeah.
But I'd probably have a little bit of performance anxiety.
You think you'd have performance anxiety?
I might need a few minutes. I might need a Viagra at that point.
You might need about three Viagras. I don't know if you triple them up, if they work any better or not. But
was his wife good looking?
I've never seen a picture ever, but somehow I don't think she was exactly a trophy wife. I don't think she was kind of the typical Italian, got married at a young age and stayed married to the same wife and probably went out and had girlfriends, so she was probably okay, but I doubt if she was a hot mama, shall we say. He was described as a highly emotional, what do you think, highly emotional, temperamental individual. FBI reports the extremely egotistic and concerned with his own personal appearance. He's a total nutcase. The walls of his home were lined with mirrors, so he could continually watch his reflections in those mirrors as he walked around. He said he could be crying in 1 minute and laughing the next. He used to like to say if he hadn't been framed for that rape when he was 17, he would have been the president of the United States. This guy is
framed for the rape.
He was framed for the rape back when he was 17. He just didn't get a chance. The police got there too quick. He brought his brothers Mario and Michael into the business. Mario was a good mob guy. They said he was almost as sick as Mad Sam, but he was. And we'll find out something about Mario later on to let you know he is a sick dude. But his brother Michael was kind of soft, and he ends up being a heroin addict and weak and can't do anything. And he knew too much, and the outfit, probably Giancana called, got hold of Mad Sam and said, you know, you got to do something about your brother. He's weak. He's a heroin addict. He's an embarrassment, and he knows too much now. In September the 17th, 1955, Chicago police got a call about the location of a fresh body. It was hadn't been sitting there for a long time in a car's trunk. So they make the call, and when they find it, they find Michael was shot in the body, but not in the head. And what was interesting in the autopsy, when they started looking at the body, had been recently bathed and cleaned up. And whoever the anonymous caller was made sure that the body was found before it went into any kind of decomposing, any decomposition. So the supposition, of course, is Mad Sam did this himself, and he wanted to make sure the body wasn't all messed up. So when they had the funeral, they could have an open casket funeral for his family.
Where normally they'd probably shoot him in the head.
Shoot him in the left eye. And stick him in a trunk and then not let nobody, they wouldn't find him for maybe a month or something or several weeks, and it'd be all decomposed and so be hard for a undertaker to fix him up.
So probably on the 16th of September 1955, his brother Michael got a call from Mad Sam.
More than likely.
Said, take a shower. We're going to go for a ride.
Yeah. Meet me over here. Get cleaned up. Meet me over here. Yeah, more than likely. All right, Aaron, I think we're up to about the end of the time here. We'll talk a second segment a little more about Mad Sam and some of the other actions that he took up there in Chicago and his relationship with Anthony Little T or... Tony the Ant Spilotro, whatever you want to call him. You know, in the wiretaps, Tuffy DeLuna always referred to him as Little T.
So, Tony Spilotro.
Yeah, Tony Spilotro. But now, people call him Tony the Ant or Ant. And Ant is not like he's a little ant. I think they did call him that to his face. I think that was just a shortened diminutive of Anthony.
Yeah, it wasn't A-U-N-T.
No, it wasn't A-U-N-T either. And it wasn't like a tiny little ant that you could stomp on. I think it was short for Anthony.
Public service announcement.
I'm going to give my public service announcement. If you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, your spouse, your employee, your sibling, your grandfather, your grandmother, any loved one, anybody you care about, your co-host, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say that folks need to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. $1.99 for your iPhone. It's great. And, of course, what you need to do is buy the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for streaming download from Amazon. For a donation of $25 or more to Gangland Wire, Gary Jenkins will autograph and send you a personal copy of Gangland Wire, the documentary, which has extras that you don't get if you get the streaming version. But you got to be in the United States.
That's true. I can send you a link if you're outside the United States to stream it and not have to deal with Amazon.
But for $25.
For $25. Or, you know, $35, you can get the book, my new book, Leaving Vegas. True story of how the FBI wiretaps destroyed the mob domination of Las Vegas. And for $100, you get a coffee cup, the book, the movie. You also can get 5 free downloads of unpublished episodes that nobody but you will ever hear. You also, for all those, for the $100 donation, and you will get 3 PDF files, the copies of the original wiretap affidavits for the Villa Capri, for the Breckenridge Inn, and a affidavit that Ken Tokyo Joe Ito signed, and in which he describes the hierarchy and the functions of all the Chicago outfit bosses. And that Villa Capri wiretap, you might be a little bit more about that. If you ever saw the movie Casino and the scene in which the character, I think it was Remo Gaggi, is talking to another mob guy in the corner store and complaining about having to go into Las Vegas, and the camera pans up to a little hidden microphone in a vent. Well, that actually happened in the Villa Capri here in Kansas City, and it was in the back of a restaurant called the Villa Capri, a bar, and this is the statement of probable cause, which tells all the reasons why they were able to get a judge to approve the installation of that microphone. So it's kind of it's a historic document is what
now,
it
was
is.
Now, was the actual wiretap, we had talked about this before, if you go back to some of our previous episodes where we talk about the FBI black bag man.
Right.
Now, was in the movie, they pan up to a vent.
Right.
But when we talked about this, in that previous episode that is free,
yeah,
you said that they actually had to run, because this was in the 70s.
Yeah, so they didn't have good wireless mics.
Yeah, they didn't have wireless mics. They literally had to run a wire, and you had said that they put the wired mic under a table.
Well, yeah, see, there wouldn't have been a vent right there close enough to pick it up. So I believe they probably chipped out a little bit in the wall, and then they can paint back over it. They can put a little spackling compound back over it where only a little pinhole of the mic and run the wire to the mic back down into the wall and then down into the basement and then out through the basement with the other phone lines, and because it just goes to the closest phone box.
Yeah, they basically attach the microphone to a telephone line, a twisted pair.
Yeah. Right. And he could have done the same thing with that's okay to stick it in a vent like that. If you have a vent in the right place and you have forced air heating and all that.
Yeah. I just remember that from our conversation about the black bag man that you had said they ran the line up and put it on the table underneath the table where they sat. And I thought that seemed kind of precarious at the time, if you listen to the episode, because I would think, you know, having working in a restaurant, people would pick up the tables and move them around, but apparently not.
I think this might have been, I'm not sure.
On that one. But in the movie, it
was a banquet and tables. So those tables were probably attached.
Maybe they were.
It's more like a booth. And I think they actually put it in a wall, not in a table that could move around. You're right about the table. If I said it was in a table, the more I'm thinking about it, I believe it was in the wall because they chipped out the drywall and installed it in behind the drywall and then ran it down into the basement.
But mostly what they heard was Staying Alive.
Staying Alive music, yeah, the song Staying Alive. But they did hear enough to go on. And then you read about in Breckenridge Inn, the next wiretap that they did and all the clues that they gathered and what their informants were telling them. They identify their informants by numbers, and so you can see what the informants were telling them at the time. It's pretty interesting reading, actually.
Yeah, actual affidavit signed, yeah, like by Ken Ito. And
that one's interesting reading, too.
That material is available.
All you got to do is donate us some money.
That's what we're asking you to do.
Go to the donate page.
No, actually, you should say this while we're at it, is we do have a page set up with Patreon. If you want to do a subscription-based payment instead of make a lump sum payment,
you can make a subscription on my donate page, but we got a Patreon page set up too.
Patreon page, so you just like every month it'll just come out of your account, you know, a couple dollars.
That's all we'd want.
$5, $10 a month, and we're trying to build that up to help our month-to-month expenses of the program.
Well, what we really want you to do is to sponsor. We want our listeners to sponsor our third season, which will start in April.
This actually technically isn't the third season, although it's a...
Wouldn't it be?
No, yeah.
It's our second season.
Because we started in March.
Or March, yeah.
I think it's so this will be... We first sat down and recorded was in March 2 years ago.
Right. So this March will be the start of our third season.
It's kind of weird because the year starts at January 1st. Yeah, that's the third season. But technically, we're still in the second season.
Our season starts in March.
Our
season opener's in March.
But we try to give you all the ways that you possibly could do to help us out, to bring this material to you. Certainly holding back some of the best material for those folks that are kind enough to give us a donation. There's another way that folks can support the program, and that would be by advertising your own business.
Yep, you can do that.
We've got an
30-second bit or a 60-second bit. Just get hold of us through the website. We'll work something out, or you can go to advertisecast.com and make a deal there, but they get a piece of that action. All right. Let's say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
On the advice of my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.